He kōna e purangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
This is Media Watch. I'm Colin Peacock. Coming up this weekend, a new survey from the Broadcasting Watchdog says people from four minority communities can feel harmed by what they see and hear in our media, and it's even driving some of them away from the stuff they broadcast. If true, that's not good. And for the BSA itself, the finding that many of them felt New Zealand doesn't have the right balance between freedom of expression and potential harm is also a worry, because it's the BSA that has to weigh the right to freedom of expression against harm when complaints are made. So what exactly is it that people say is harming them? And what will the watchdog do about this new research? That's later. But first, there's no shortage of bad news about bad vibes in our big cities right now, and heaps about the woes of one in particular.
Time for a quick bit of feedback here. This is about the idea that Wellington has got a wee bit sad. This texter says, I walked around the city on Monday afternoon. It was like a ghost town. It's been wiped out, and I don't think the government can pretend that's not the case.
Yeah, another says the only vibrancy in Wellington is from the wind.
That was The Morning Report co-hosts Corin Dan and Ingrid Hipkiss on Wednesday, shortly after a report on the woes of Wellington had aired on the programme. Well, we all look a wee bit sad from time to time, so how serious is this slump?
Another one refers to the 50 empty shops in Wellington saying, well, Wellington doesn't know how lucky it is, which is, just to that point that there are a lot of places around the country also feeling a bit desolate at the moment.
And that's a fair point. And right now, none more so than Raisihi, Oakune and Tangiwai, where 230 jobs at two nearby mills had just gone up in smoke, including that of Jeff Tamatoroa, who told RNZ's Alexa Cook this.
Our local towns, it's probably gonna wreck them, especially a lot of us young ones, We're probably gonna disappear off the Aussie or something if we can. So yeah, it's a big loss to the community and to the jobs.
And in the New Zealand Herald that same morning, under the headline, Is Wellington Dying or Just Feeling Sorry for Itself?, Deputy Political Editor Thomas Coughlin said Wellington's not doing too badly, actually, according to available economic stats and some economists, and certainly better than, for example, the Bay of Plenty, which he said now has the highest unemployment rate in the country. And while no politicians are talking about that, they probably should be, said Thomas Coughlin. And maybe the media should be too. The Herald's Thomas Coughlin also cited data showing Wellington is actually one of the more productive regions in New Zealand right now, in spite of what he called bashing from the right, which labels the public service as inefficient. Thomas Coughlin went on to point out that solid economic evidence of the impact of government belt tightening and public sector job cutting won't actually be available for months, and that means...
Much of the reporting on the city's problems has been necessarily anecdotal.
And much of the commentary in the media too, he could have added. For example, this was Mike Hosking's take on his ZB breakfast show last Monday.
Pandoro announced on Friday that they're closing in Wellington. Now, they aren't the first, obviously. There's been a growing business lately on stories about closing hospo businesses in the capital. The owner, I thought, was interesting, though. It seems for him to be a mix of COVID, as people went home and not everyone came back, also of cycleways and bus lanes killing the traffic, and road cones and construction.
And according to Wellington's daily paper, The Post, the owner also cited the economic downturn, redundancies in the public sector and the Wellington City Council. But as RNZ's report on that noted, none of his cafes are actually on roads with cycleways, and the spin-off's Wellington editor Joel McManus pointed out forensically that the use of each one of the nearest cycleways has actually gone up markedly, bringing more people into the CBD. Anyway, back on News Talk ZB, Mike Hosking's anecdotal conclusion was this.
Pandoro, I mean, names that have been around, survived a lot, seen hard times, and yet this time they can't do it. What's that tell you about how badly this place has been wrecked?
But it's not just Mike Hosking and News Talk ZB zeroing in on the capital's CBD business and services. In the Sunday Star Times last weekend, the editor Tracy Watkins wrote this.
A string of businesses have shut their doors for good after reeling from one downturn to the next. The capital feels like it's gradually hollowing out.
In her editorial, she cited working from home, public service cuts, the cost of living, car parking, and the disruption of council projects and roadworks, and
soaring insurance costs due to the capital's high risk factors, coupled with a massive infrastructure deficit, big rates rises, and the punishing costs of earthquake strengthening.
7 days earlier, she was also telling her nationwide readers of the Sunday Star Times,
of course, some people will blame the media. But the capital isn't in a slump because it was on our front page, and things won't get better if we just stop talking about it.
true, but Tracy Watkins then went on to say, we deserve to cop some criticism. But for what?
Do we dwell on the negatives too much? Maybe we should be more critical before applying the word crisis to any situation.
An interesting point. And last Sunday, Tracy Watkins concluded her editorial,
maybe we should do a better job of talking about how we can use our voice to be part of the solution rather than the problem.
Maybe. And so could Wellington's daily paper, The Post, which Tracy Watkins also edits for the same publisher, Stuff. The previous Friday, the day the Pandoro cafes closed, the front page of The Post carried what it called ideas that might improve the ailing capital if we're bold enough. And it sent a reporter downtown to find spots of life among the reported nighttime dead zone. Last Monday, the front page carried a picture of the Wellington waterfront on one of those unbeatable good days, and inside there were readers' creative ideas for how to snap the city out of its funk. Now, some of these were not really likely to get on the City Council's agenda, such as a floating cycleway that crosses the water from Evans Bay to the Miramar Peninsula. Still, that is blue sky thinking, or blue water, perhaps. But elsewhere in the Post that day, there was news that a western suburb cycleway had been paused by the council and another cost increase in the shared path on the seawall between Nauranga and Petone, and penguins nesting under it as well. But there was some good news, that 80 of the council's shoulder-high roadside solar panels are still working. Though the bad news was, that's in spite of the fact they'd all been smashed by vandals. Meanwhile, the Stuff website the next day reported that a once bustling central city street was facing a death knell, according to Retail NZ. And cutting across the Post's declared focus on solutions, Stuff's story asked the online readers, what's Wellington's biggest problem? And then offered them a smorgasbord, including the global economy, car parks, public transport, and failing water pipes. For the record, the Wellington City Council topped the poll, with 15% of readers also reckoning cycleways were the biggest problem. This weekend, the Post stepped up its efforts to constructively address what it had tagged 6 months ago, the capital crisis. It's time to see what's improved and what still needs urgent attention, and to champion what's great about Wellington, said the editor Tracy Watkins, when she launched A Capital Conversation, this time pitched as a genuine contribution to the city's revitalisation. Now, this kicked off with a spotlight on the Golden Mile, on empty sites and buildings elsewhere, the past and present of Wellington's hospo and retail, and there was more to come, including, she said, why parking and cycle lanes have become so divisive. Though one reason for that is opinion pieces like the one in the Post last week, which branded cyclists as the new elite, claiming many of them ride bikes worth $10,000, which is a bit rich for the lowest cost form of transport there is, next to walking. Elsewhere in this weekend's Capital Conversation content, there was a letter from the future by marketing professional Helen Milner, hypothesising about life in sustainable Wellington in the year 2040, when everything's been fixed and even the Phoenix can fill the stadium every weekend. But there was also a written warning in the Weekend Post from the veteran former MP and Minister Peter Dunn, who said that unfortunately it'll take a lot more than mood-lifting frothy newspaper articles. Now, the business closures are, of course, not just a problem in the Wellington CBD. Just last month, the Post reported that the mall in Nainai in the Hutt Valley was dying and Johnsonville Mall was desolate and in despair. So it was a little bit of a change of tone for Stuff last weekend when its new hire, Patrick Gower, went to Marurewa's South Mall.
So what did we learn today? Well, South Mall is not dead. And why? Why is this mall alive when so many others are dying? Well, it's because of Neil. Neil is a good Kiwi and he is a leader who has fought for the community and created a mall that is alive and well and actually cooks up some pretty bloody good tucker.
Well, it was Neil Punjar, the owner of South Mall, that Patrick Gower was crediting there, but in his four-minute video, he didn't really say how he did it, and the five-paragraph story on the Stuff website only said that the shop's operators own the mall as a collective and keep it clean and safe, and that was about it. There was a lot of detail, though, in a long illustrated piece for TVNZ's One News Now website this week, asking, are New Zealand's biggest cities becoming boring backwaters? And no was the conclusion of its author, Julie Hill, who reckoned they're not dying, just changing. Auckland's downtown is heaving, she said, if you look in the right places at the right times. And a quality of life survey had just given Christchurch top points for work-life balance, and a third of people thought the city had improved in the past year. And a Gen X age Wellingtonian who lives downtown told Julie Hill that events there were still pulling lively crowds, and if it does seem a bit grim in the capital downtown, well, that's because it's been winter. Scarf up and wait for more of those unbeatable good days, he said. And also chucking in his two cents this week was another Wellington veteran who's been tracking the doom and gloom reports from afar in recent months. Patrick Smelly, the founder and editor of Business Desk, said he'd found similar problems in most of the European countries he'd just visited, but without what he called a chorus of angst in the media that the country seemed to be failing, or the word crisis being used to describe almost everything. New Zealand is less like a poor country without a future, he said, and more like a rich country that's often been poorly run. And every other country he went to, he said, including the US, has plenty of neglected roads and many have crappy water infrastructure, in his words. Most of the cities that had more than a million people in them had cheap and good public transport. And then he wound up with this.
Like it or not, cycling's part of the future. Get over it.
Easier said than done, though, right here in New Zealand right now. This week, the Broadcasting Watchdog issued a worrying statement for broadcasters, which said half of diverse audiences avoid TV or radio because there's too much misinformation and inappropriate content. And that's worrying stuff from the Broadcasting Standards Authority on the face of it. But how do they know? Well, the BSA said this came from a new survey carried out in April and May of Māori and Pacific people and people from New Zealand's Asian and Muslim communities, just under 500 people in total, and that was after focus groups had been held to guide the questions that were put to them in the survey. And this eventually found that more than three quarters of Māori, Asian and Muslim respondents felt exposure to offensive, discriminatory or controversial views was a problem in New Zealand. And the same was true for 85% of Pacific people surveyed. The BSA statement also said about a third of Māori, Pacific peoples and Muslims said they read, saw or heard such views shared publicly in the past 6 months. And few felt that New Zealand has the balance right between freedom of expression and potential harm. Now that's also worrying for the BSA itself, because since 2019, it's had the mission, freedom in broadcasting without harm. And when complaints are made about something on the air, the BSA must judge the right to freedom of expression against the harm that might already have arisen. The BSA's chief executive, Stacey Wood, said in the statement that the sobering insights in the survey will be useful in informing future BSA decisions. But a year ago, Stacey Wood told MediaWatch this.
People are being harmed, and traditional broadcasting media is not where most of the harm is happening.
And in this new survey, it was social media that was most often cited as a source of offensive material. However, the BSA only has jurisdiction over outlets which broadcast on radio and TV, and what they put on their own online platforms. Now, predictably, perhaps it wasn't long before the lobby group, the Free Speech Union, put out a statement of its own in response, accusing the BSA of, in its words, banging a drum for censorship by claiming freedom of expression causes harm. And the Free Speech Union's chief executive, Jonathan Ayling, said that the report on the survey offered no definition of harm, and
we're concerned that this report will lead to unpopular views being censored on the basis of them being harmful. Who will define what is a harmful view?
And Jonathan Ayling reckoned the real risk of harm here was being unable to think and speak freely. Now, interestingly, significant proportions of each of the four communities surveyed by the BSA also felt people should be able to say what they want, as you can always turn off the program or choose not to listen. So what exactly then is the harm that persuaded so many from those four minority communities that freedom of speech needs to be tempered for the media? Well, asked about that on Radio Waitea this week, the BSA's chief executive Stacey Wood said the harmful stuff cited by the respondents was not necessarily a breach of broadcasting standards.
Probably a lot of them wouldn't breach broadcasting standards, because when we're taking complaints, it has to be about a broadcast, it has to meet a high threshold of harm to counterbalance freedom of expression and people being able to say what they want. So there was a recognition among respondents that individually these pieces of media that they're seeing might not breach standards, but cumulatively the effect of seeing negative, controversial, discriminatory content is really quite damaging.
So if that's so, is there anything really here for the BSA to consider? A question I put to the BSA's Stacey Wood, along with the question, does it really make the case for more regulation of media other than broadcasting?
Yeah, so there's a big range of content covered here. And a lot of it, even the people interviewed in the focus groups for this survey, recognise that each piece of content that they might have found harmful or hurtful on its own might be unlikely to breach broadcasting standards. It's often the cumulative effect of hearing and seeing these negative or inaccurate or offensive views and content over and over again over time. It builds up and causes this hurt and resentment and eventually causes people to switch off. And it's often not something that a broadcaster has done wrong per se. I mean, the broadcaster's job is to report what's happening in the news and to talk to, for instance, politicians about what's happening in Parliament. And if the issues of the day are controversial or hurtful to certain groups of people, then that's going to contribute to that feeling, even though the broadcaster's not being offensive in themselves and how they're reporting it. So it's not a finger-pointing exercise. Just a snapshot or an overview of how the media is affecting groups of people in our society who we as a regulator don't often hear from.
Sure. So if it's affecting them to the point where they're tuning out of the media, that is obviously a worry and something broadcasters would want to take seriously. But it's still not clear to me from the report. Is it the amplification, the platforming or whatever of people with views that are offensive? I mean, is an individual saying bad things about immigrants, or what are we really talking about here?
Yeah, so there are a few specific examples in the report, and remembering that the report covers social media as well as broadcasting, so that necessarily brings in another level of toxicity. But some of the messaging that people identified as having heard in the last 6 months included stereotypes like, oh, Māori or Pacific peoples are all on a benefit, or misinformation like migrants are coming to steal all your jobs. There was an example of Destiny Church inciting negativity and hate towards...
Was that in social media or on a broadcast?
That wasn't specified.
Right.
And I think the other thing that struck me was across Māori, Pacific peoples and Asian people, anti-Māori sentiment was identified as one of the most common types of negative content that encountered.
You have jurisdiction over broadcasters, you don't over social media at the Broadcasting Standards Authority in the report. Some people felt the repeating of offensive comments on social media in mainstream media was a problem. I mean, I have to say, I don't hear an awful lot of that, like unfiltered offensive views. Is this really a social media problem rather than a broadcast one? Or are you seeing complaints at the BSA there is discriminatory content on mainstream media broadcast platforms?
Not that issue specifically. I think a lot of it goes the other way. So rather than social media comments being rebroadcast on the airwaves, frequently what you'll see is broadcast or radio content being put on the likes of YouTube and then attracting a whole lot of toxic commentary. So if people go and watch that on YouTube, scroll through the comments, they're seeing just an echo chamber of the most vile comments you can think of.
To take possibly a hypothetical example, but if there's relatively responsible coverage, it breaches no broadcasting standards by, say, TVNZ reporting on the issue of migrant exploitation, and that gets put on TVNZ's YouTube page, as some news packages are, and could attract a whole lot of racist responses, which will then, you know, offend and alarm people from the communities in question.
That's right. And, you know, a lot of media do a really good job of moderating and jumping on those comments as soon as they pop up, or limiting comments, but other media don't. And there's also the issue that if somebody from the audience uploads a clip outside of the media channels, they've got no control over that.
One of the findings here, it's highlighted in key findings of the report, clear majorities felt that exposure to offensive, discriminatory or controversial views was a problem in New Zealand. And it says there was little differentiation between the level of harm caused by the various types of offensive views. But They are very different, aren't they? If it's controversial views is different from offensive or discriminatory stuff. And as you know, the bar for discrimination or denigration in the broadcasting codes is very high. So those are very different things, aren't they?
I guess the purpose of the research wasn't to find out how much objectionable or content that would breach broadcasting standards is out there. We were more interested in the effects on people and what they're seeing, how much what they're doing in response to what they're seeing and hearing. So, and predictably, as soon as this report went out, there were groups and people who were quick to label us wannabe censors, claim that this report is a call for stronger censorship laws in New Zealand. We have not called for that.
Well, for example, another finding here, there's around a third of Māori Pacific peoples and Muslims recalled views they considered offensive, discriminatory or controversial being shared publicly. But quite large proportions for each group were unsure, range between 28 and 39%. Mm. So, I mean, can we really say that there's a clear majority that felt they'd been exposed to offensive, discriminatory or controversial views if as many as one in three, or between a quarter and a third for each group, weren't even sure whether they'd seen these comments or not?
I think the various findings in the report of people who were more confident painted an overall picture of harm experienced. The individual findings are not clear on what should be done about this. I also was interested to see that large minorities in each group felt that regulatory settings are fine, that people should be able to say whatever they want with no limits, that if you don't like something that you hear or see, you can simply switch the television and radio off. Mm. So there's not a clear call for strong limits on what can be said or shown on media.
If people if that level of people aren't really sure whether they've seen this content shared or not that they believe to be offensive, doesn't that undermine anyone saying, actually, this is evidence that we do need stronger limits?
That question asked specifically about the last 6 months and asked for people to call on their recall of specific content they might have seen. So I think it probably reflects an inability to think of it an example, a specific example, as opposed to a general recollection. Professional media in New Zealand typically don't want to be broadcasting discriminatory and denigrating content. There's also a very high threshold for finding a breach of that standard. So a lot of the complaints that we do get under that standard are not upheld. But it's one of those situations where hearing that low-level negativity over and over can hurt people, even if individually the pieces of content don't break any rules.
And as you mentioned there, there was a significant proportion for each of the four groups you surveyed saying people should have the right to say what they want. You can always tune out or turn off the program. Were you surprised by the balance of that against those who felt that, because another finding of the report, a majority felt that freedom of expression should be tempered by the need to respect the views of others?
Yeah, it is very dangerous to start limiting that beyond the obvious sort of terrorist content, etc. If the result of having very low limits on social media and other media is that people stop engaging with it and turn away and potentially turn down less trustworthy sources of information, that is a problem.
So you described these results as sobering in your statement, and you said this will inform our responses to broadcasting complaints decisions in the future. But how will it do that if, as we've established, most of the stuff that's really causing offence isn't actually being broadcast on major broadcasters that fall under your jurisdiction or on the online platforms they operate?
Mm. So one of the things that came through in the survey was, and takes a long time to get through, so we're going to try and make that a bit more accessible to people. But
your statement is that will inform the decisions that we make. So, I mean, how will it change? Does this mean a lowering of the bar for things like discrimination and denigration?
Context is always important in every BSA decision. So whenever the authority is considering a piece of media, they're considering the context in which it's been presented to audiences, and audience expectations around what they see and hear are always a consideration. this is useful background context for them to have, even if it doesn't necessarily lead to a change in outcome.
But you're weighing up the right to freedom of expression,
yeah,
both for broadcasters and the freedom of expression rights of the people they are amplifying or broadcasting,
yeah,
against
potential
the harm, the potential harm that could be caused. So does this effectively for you, when it's something that could cause harm to one of these particular four groups, does this shift the bar to you towards putting greater weight on the harm that could be caused to them as a result of having this data and against freedom of expression?
So I can't comment on whether it would alter how they consider decisions. I would say that it's useful information about the harms caused to groups of people is inherently going to be useful when you're balancing freedom of expression against potential harm, if you know more about the harm or the potential harm that's being caused to people.
Last time we spoke, Stacey, was when you were voicing support for, in fact, urging reform of regulation of media content to extend it to, you know, the online realm, because as we know, our system is 30 years old in places. We have different regulators for different media, which is not the way it's done in other countries where they've moved with the digital times, so to speak. Since then, the Minister of Internal Affairs, Brooke van Velden, has put a stop to it. They're not interested in pursuing any kind of one-stop shop for regulation. Is that partly what this report is about, to say a lot of this stuff is out of our range? There's nothing much can be done about the things that people are citing here when it's social media that's at the heart of it?
Yeah, it was disappointing. And we are still hopeful to see a review of the Broadcasting Act within our lifetimes. But it's difficult to carve that out completely from...
Within our lifetimes doesn't make it sound like you think it's imminent or
I'm
any kind of priority.
I'm being a little bit facetious. I'm still hopeful that we may see action within this political term, but I've been optimistic for a while, so I'm trying to temper my expectations. Yeah. Well,
what do you want broadcasters to do in response to this?
Yeah, I think journalists and broadcasters are probably well aware of a lot of these issues. They're seeing the response and the comments day in, day out. But just having this awareness of how news and other media affects people in the back of their mind, especially if the professionals working in the news are not from any of those minority groups, I think it's just a reminder to have empathy, think of things from other people's perspectives. Yeah, certainly got no fingers to point at New Zealand's professional media in general.
Well, Television New Zealand, for example, will close down comments or and then announce to on the social media platforms when they post the stories, they'll post a note to say, because we want to encourage respectful debate, we close off comments on some contentious issues. I'm kind of paraphrasing, but they give people a heads up. Do you think that's a good approach and one that serves these communities you've surveyed well?
Yeah, I think that's really responsible, because social media gets hijacked. You know, the comments on social media are not coming in good faith and often not coming from real people on contentious issues that are likely to stoke division between people. You often see them get hijacked by overseas groups or trolls or bots.
Limits people's freedom of expression, though. I mean, you know, it's not quite talk radio where they're, you know, responsible for what they put out on the airwaves. If people want to make those comments, have those debates, as some people in the survey said.
Yeah, well, freedom of expression goes both ways, right? Like if a media channel is putting something up on social media and they don't want to hear from racists or people with horrible attitudes towards people from other races, then they have the right not to have that on their post. They have the right to shut it down.
That was Stacey Wood, Chief Executive of the Broadcasting Standards Authority, talking to me there about a new report it's released called Freedom of Expression and Harms Impacting Diverse Communities. And this found a majority of 500 Māori, Pacific, Asian and Muslim New Zealanders felt that exposure to offensive, discriminatory or controversial views was a problem in New Zealand media. The biggest global media event of this past week was that televised US presidential debate between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris. And while most analysts concluded it had been an embarrassment for Trump and that Harris had easily outmaneuvered him, TVNZ's Logan Church had a surprising verdict on what he'd seen on One News last Wednesday.
While there were definitely fireworks on the debate stage tonight, there certainly wasn't that 1-2 punch. There wasn't that knockout line that I think clinched the debate for either side. And the polls that have been raced out this evening after the debate reflect that.
Well, it was a debate and not a boxing match, so the candidates didn't actually knock each other out. Though he was echoed in that in Australia by ABC presenter Lee Sales, who had this reaction.
Neither side landed a knockout blow or even a killer line, and that's a bigger problem for Kamala Harris than Donald Trump.
There weren't many non-partisan pundits or correspondents calling it as inconclusive, though there were plenty of partisan ones in the so-called spin room, populated by pundits and politicians bigging up their own candidate, as Logan Church discovered.
Allies from both sides emerged to defend their candidate's performance.
Donald Trump spoke clearly to the undecided voters out there.
I mean, obviously Kamala won.
In this week's Midweek Media Watch, Hayden Donnell took a look at the big challenge for the moderators and the rest of the media.
He would be saying something like, they're eating dogs, she's going to kill everyone in this country. And they would say, thank you, President Trump, and now to you. It's kind of like if you're hosting a dinner party and you're going, how do you do, good sir, to a person that's kind of chucking the food against the walls and weighing on the furniture. This has actually got a term for it. Now, sane washing. It's what Parker Malloy, the media commentator, has termed it as. So I saw the New York Times headline about this debate: fierce exchanges over country's future dominate debate. I mean, it's true.
It's technically true,
but it doesn't really actually convey the reality of the situation.
If you missed Midweek Media Watch on RNZ National last Wednesday, it's on the new Media Watch podcast page at rnz.co.nz or available for free in our podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts. And finally, on Media Watch this weekend, as we heard at the start of the show, our media aren't painting the greatest picture of our cities at the moment, and the hospitality scene won't have enjoyed the international food magazine Chef's Pencil saying this week that Auckland's restaurants close earlier than they do anywhere else in the world. And when Newstalk ZB's Sunday at 6 show last weekend asked its listeners what their favourite overseas places to visit are, well, many cited the joys of late-night dining and drinking in places like Paris and Barcelona. But caller George had another handy hint.
George, good evening.
Just going into a tunnel, look up where to wee on an app. It tells you every toilet in the world. Petrol stations, restaurants, the public lose the whole lot.
Good to know. And then well-travelled Dave called in with his 2 cents on where to spend a penny.
Another thing about where to pee.
Yes.
And it's still legal in New Zealand for a male to pee beside his left-hand rear wheel of a vehicle.
Oh, really?
I'd assume it would be legal.
It goes back to the horse and cart days, and that is still legal.
Wow, I was not aware of that one, David. You've just taught me something tonight. I'm going to go and look that one up. But I don't know if I want to advertise that too widely, but I'm definitely going to look that up. Thanks heaps for your call.
Well, if Frank Ritchie does look that up, he'll probably find out that's actually pretty bad advice, which we've heard before. Back in May, another caller called George, also in Wellington, told ZB listeners this.
There was a law passed in the 1900s where a gentleman can pee legally on the front left-hand tyre of his car. And the funniest thing I've seen is a guy pulled up in the petrol station in Warkworth with a really fancy big ute. Four of them got out, three went in to buy pies and stuff, and the fourth peed on the front right-hand driver's door instead of using the loo. And I thought, what on earth is that about? And it was his mate's car.
Now, such a law did apparently exist in the UK about 100 years ago, but after combing the statute books here, we could find no such legal loophole. And the Summary Offences Act of 1981 is pretty clear. Every person who urinates in any public place other than a lavatory is liable to a fine not exceeding $200. It is a defence to prosecution, though, if the defendant can prove that he had a reasonable grounds for believing he would not be observed. And the law does specify he. But there's no exemption for urinating on a ute, even if it's your mates in a petrol station, as we've now discovered. That's all from us here at Media Watch for this weekend. Thanks for listening. I'll be back with Midweek Media Watch next Wednesday, and then we'll be back again with Media Watch, as usual, next weekend. Follow Media Watch and listen on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any podcast app to make sure you never miss an episode. And if you have any thoughts to share with us or ideas for us to follow up, do get in touch. Email us, mediawatch@rnz.co.nz, or you'll find us as Media Watch NZ on X. And you can even write us a letter and send it to PO Box 123 Wellington. That's all from us for now. Ka kite, catch you again for Midweek Media Watch from Wednesday night.